Welcome to Business Watch. Well, we're at the halfway mark of the year, if you can believe it, and that means banking results around the corner, both globally and locally. We see rates continuing to rise and inflation remaining sticky. Stage 6 load shedding and record high fuel prices have certainly done nothing to help brighten the mood after a surprisingly good first quarter GDP print. Globally, the stress levels in the Chinese banking sector have me extremely concerned. We just saw Chinese authorities on Sunday violently dispersing a peaceful protest by hundreds of depositors who sought in vain to demand their life savings back from banks that have run into a deepening cash crisis. And we've seen since April, four rural banks in China's central Henan province have frozen millions of dollars worth of deposits, threatening the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of customers in an economy already battered by draconian COVID lockdown. So China's banking sector, in terms of bank assets to GDP, is amongst the biggest in the world and has certainly for years been a concern for analysts due to its shadowy nature. So time to talk banking with Nwandle Mthombeni, senior banks analyst at Intellidex, and David Buckham, MD of Monocle Solutions. Nwandle, let's just start with the stat of the month locally. Recent bank trading updates suggest continued growth in vehicle financing, despite higher interest rates and obviously fuel prices increasing. So that's quite interesting. Take me through some of the trends that this is showing.
Yes, it's definitely interesting that what we've seen, actually since July, around July last year, we've seen an increasing rolling average of the number of passenger vehicle sales. And on the other side of passenger vehicle sales is obviously the financing elements of it. We're also seeing that, you know, the banks themselves have shown some strong growth in terms of advances in the vehicle and asset financing space. And we had, you know, in the last couple of quarter of months, it's actually picked up even more. And surprisingly, even last week, we had some new numbers out saying that new passenger vehicle sales are on the rise. And this is, you know, quite a bit counterintuitive if you think about where the petrol price has gone. But it seems like there was just a demand. Obviously, lower rates was a big tailwind for it. But we've seen rates go up now. So the expectation was that there'd be a slowdown, but there's still been some momentum. But I think the outlook now is, you know, it's going to change with the reality of petrol being around 25 rand a litre.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And it looks like it's not going to be coming down anytime soon, despite what the DA are trying to do with their private members bill to bring down the price of petrol. But for the bank sector, I mean, this is obviously a very large part of, you know, the bank's retail book. If you look at home loans, David, if you look at vehicle financing, a big chunk of that. What do you take out of this very robust growth in lending to the vehicle and asset finance book?
Yes, I think it's very positive. I think the cause of the increasing demand that you're seeing through those numbers from Intellidex is suppressed demand during 2020 and 2021, where people were unable really to spend money, and we had fairly responsible fiscal behavior and fairly responsible monetary behavior. So I think that's coming through the numbers. You do see a very interesting kind of tailing off in the last 2 months, which I think might have to do with increased provisions or increased stage one loan loss provisions, as the report says. But I think overall it's a very encouraging sign in the South African economy, in a rand-based economy, to see people buying new vehicles and to see people buying, to the point of the report, second-hand vehicles, which you see in the asset finance numbers through the banks.
Yeah, a very good read through there for the likes of We Buy Cars as well. When we look at the Intellidex Momentum Index, just remind us, Nwandle, how you construct this and what it reveals about the health of South Africa's banks for June.
So what we do is basically break it down into a few components, where we measure the balance sheets of the banks, whether there's growth in terms of deposits and lending. And then there's also the income statement side, where we look at revenue growth as well as impairments, how they're performing. And then we measure, you know, overall profitability in terms of ROE measure. And we combine this to come up with the momentum that tells us, you know, how has the sector been faring? And we watch this on a month-to-month basis to see, you know, is the momentum positive? Is there a speeding up of growth, or is it negative where there's a slowdown? And overall, what we found is that you know, for most part of the last couple of months, you've seen some strong positive momentum. We saw deposits, in, you know, positive movements in deposit growth, lending growth also saw some recovery. More specifically, you know, revenue was quite strong, and obviously impairments. But what happened in the last print in April is that we actually saw the dip due to impairments now pulling it down. And this, you know, goes hand in hand with the fact that, you, for example, the vehicles financing actually increased. And with that, you know, the minute you write on a new item, you need to obviously put through some stage one provisions coming through. So in an environment where we would expect that there will be continuing lower impairment charges, these are being offset by, you know, loan growth. And to the extent where if it's something as, you know, big ticket items like vehicle financing and mortgage financing, you obviously have to put through, you know, stage one provisions. And we've seen that while the other factors are showing good progress, they are being pulled down by a bit of a tick up in impairments.
Yeah, a bit of a tick up in impairments is the one that certainly worries me if we were to look into the future. I think in the rearview mirror, that story, that really good Q1 number is starting to be offset, David, by load shedding, stage six, fuel price increases. The general mood out there is seemingly at an absolute low. We're going from stage six to terminal six at ORT. You know, there's a brain drain happening because of all of this. So, I mean, what do you see as the outlook for the banks as we head into the second half on the back of what we've seen as the big drivers in this improvement?
It must be very frustrating for the banks, as it is for many of us. The sheer iniquity of it is that we've come through lockdown. We've had a very responsible monetary policy, and we're about to open up. We take our masks off, and now we're going out and about. And all my friends that have shut down their businesses are opening up their businesses, making shirts again, selling at the airport to foreigners. There's people flying in from Sweden. And then we have stage six, and it's just really kind of clear that we need either some kind of big finance solution, and I might even say like three LNG ports would be nice, where it's like 100 billion rand would be a good investment and just get it done, or we continue along this path of shallow growth and loss of key skills. So I think it's time to do something big, and I think private sector has to step in and go to the banks and say, go to government and say, and the banks should do it. Go to government and say, we need to do something big, and there are lots of options. There are a lot of different options for us.
That is a frustrating thing, Lwandle, and it is, you know, it's not a strictly kind of finance and banking topic, although it is, because you've got to fund these big ticket items. But I think load shedding, it is diffuse across the entire economy. There isn't a sector that isn't hurt by the stage six load shedding, and I think the unquantifiable damage that it's doing to confidence, which is very difficult to really measure in rand terms, but also to skills. I mean, what do you make of the banks maybe stepping up here and playing a bit more of a leadership role in terms of making suggestions to government on a way out?
I think that's what banks do all the time. I mean, you know, the banking sector and the financial sector is at the heart of the economy. Nothing, you know, happens without, you know, the banking sector. So they play a huge, huge, huge role in terms of, you know, any sort of, you know, government engagement. You know, they have to, they are at the forefront. They have to be. So they're quite significant. You know, if, you know, the banks, I mean, if the bank were to fail now, you know, the economy would, you know, be affected quite badly. So I think the banking sector is always proactive in engaging with government on all issues. And, you know, every time, you know, we have, you know, stage six and it's prolonged, it shaves off GDP growth. And it shaves off GDP growth, it also changes the outlook for banks in terms of how they're going to participate in the economy in terms of lending and providing financing. So they're most definitely affected. So not just from the business aspect of it, but, you know, they're looking at this and also thinking that in terms of providing support to clients, it's going to be very difficult. So I think they are always ongoing and engaging government, not just on you know, being able to do something like the ESCOM, but in terms of policy decisions as well, everything that affects the economy, they do play a pivotal role, and they carry on engaging.
Yeah, I think the big issue for me is also we focus a lot on the supply side. And David, you did mention, you know, a couple of LNG ports or whatever it is that is the solution to bring new megawatts onto the grid. I think in that intervening period, as we wait for new megawatts to be built and to come onto the grid, we need to do something on the demand side as well, because the economy simply cannot cope and continue to cope with anything like stage 6 load shedding. We were starting to learn to live with stage 4 and below, and we could plan our lives, businesses could plan their lives around it, but I think when it gets above that, when you're losing 10 hours of productive time a day due to it, it's too much. I want to come back to the global picture, the macro picture against which this conversation is taking place as a backdrop, and that's the mea culpa to an extent from central banks around the world. They were caught flat-footed with the inflation narrative. They have been hiking and front-loading rather aggressively. We see the Bank of Canada and New Zealand set to hike again this week, I think. David, from your vantage point, given the global interest rate upswing, what do you think the key risks are here? Because in some categories we are seeing inflation roll over, and my concern is that we see an overreaction potentially because the central banks are trying to regain credibility, and we really push the global economy into a deeper recession than need be.
So it's a really interesting question, Michael, and Paul Krugman on Sunday tried to address this question in the New York Times, which is that if we go too fast, if the Fed goes too fast, then you'll bring upon a recession. And if you go too slow, then you have inflation for 2-3 years and you erode people's savings. It's my personal opinion that we've never had a situation like this before where there's been so much money and so much M2. So I don't think the Fed knows the answer to the question, and I think they're looking at the data like we are, so waiting desperately for the inflation number from last month and then seeing step by step. But factually speaking, Paul Volcker was at equivalent nominal value of inflation to the federal funds rate. So when inflation went to 8% in 1979, early 1980, the federal funds rate was 800 basis points. And so he pushed the federal funds rate to, you know, up about 1,000 basis points to rein in inflation. Now we're starting the process of reining in inflation, which is 8%, 8.5% in the U.S., with the federal funds rate at 0.5%. So we're 750 basis points to 800 basis points behind the curve from a nominal rate perspective. So what I'm concerned about is that we simply don't know how this thing's going to turn out. There's 10 times more money in the world than there was in 1980 relative to population.
That creates all kinds of risks of policy error. What are we seeing if we track central bank hikes, and what do you expect to see in the one day from the SARB, which so far has tended to err on the side of caution and front load?
We can definitely expect a few more hikes to happen this year. Maybe, you know, the 350 basis point hikes, which would get us to 150 basis points higher. And, you know, of course, they also provide guidance in terms of what the QPM model, which is what they use in their monetary policy decision making. And we're going to probably have more. I think, you know, what's the big debate is the quantum of that. So, you know, there's, you know, many thinking, you know, look, we just had a petrol hike last week, which is going to, you know, hurt consumers more and put some more pressure onto inflation. So is it going to be a 75 basis point or is it a 50 basis point? I think that is the question, you know, the quantum of these hikes now going forward. Yeah. And obviously this is going to put, you know, tremendous more pressure onto the economy and consumers. However, you know, central banks have to be seen as doing something. They can't do nothing. And you use, you know, whatever tools in terms of monetary policy you can do to curb inflation. Unfortunately, these are still supply side shocks. And what they're trying to do is, you know, target the second round effects. And it's going to be very, very tough for the consumer going forward. But we definitely are expecting, you know, across, even globally, you know, we're expecting like July is going to be another rate decision for a couple of central banks. And we see, you know, another 50, 75 basis point region there. And I must say, we're actually very close to closing the gap from terms of, you know, the trough of 300 basis points to where we even started in this process. Yeah. So, you know, we're giving away all the relief that, you know, that we got at the start of the pandemic now. And that's how fast we've been moving.
Yeah, it does. It's such a difficult environment to be a central banker in. And back to your earlier point, David, just because of the quantum of liquidity that has been pumped into the system in successive crises, from the global financial crisis and then COVID, and all of that, you know, makes it extremely difficult. For us here in South Africa, though, I mean, clearly there has to be some hiking in lockstep with what goes on to protect the currency to some extent, even though the SARB would say that that's not its mandate. It's trying to look after inflation. But if you erode the rand, then inflation will happen naturally. But you just see the dispersion in oil price forecasts for this year. I saw two major U.S. investment banks, one with the target of $60 by year-end, the other with the target of over $300 by year-end. So it just shows you, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty in the market at the moment. But to come back to the Reserve Bank, what would you do if you were one of the MPC members at this stage? Would you err on the side of caution, considering that there isn't that demand side pressure in the economy? Consumers are not going out and spending, and they're under pressure as it is from rising fuel costs and the like. How would you go?
Michael, I'm afraid to say I would definitely go in lockstep with the US. I think that, I would go in lockstep with the U.S. We need the carry trade. We need the rand to hold strong. It's a liquid currency. We need investments. We don't want U.S. dollar or euro investments pulling out of the country because of the poor carry cost. We need government bonds that are attractive. So from a monetary perspective, I would argue that we need to go up. I know that wouldn't make me a popular member of the MPC. From a demand perspective, I think that there are alleviations that can occur in terms of the petrol price. So there are good signs that the price of oil will come down, and that there has been some price gouging or some slowness to move on price at the petrol stations in the US. Mm. And I do believe that there's some alleviation on the petrol price front. That will be coming soon, and I think that unfortunately the carry cost on our homes and our cars need to go up to protect our overall currency and economy.
Yeah, that is the bottom line. There's another big important issue that happened in the regulatory front for buy now, pay later, BNPL as it's become known. Before we talk about that, what exactly is BNPL?
So buy now, pay later is exactly as it suggests. You know, as a consumer, you get to go, you know, online and buy an item, and you put down a deposit and it's paid over a few months. It's pretty much like a lay-by gone, you know, opposite of a lay-by in the lay-by, where, you know, usually you pay off and then you get the item. But with buy now, pay later, you can go online with the retailer, make a purchase of an item, and then you have maybe 3 months, around 3 months, 6 months, depending on the provider, to pay it off, and you get it at the same time. It's different to, you know, say a loan, because, you know, there's no interest provided charged on there. Mm. So it's basically just you being able to get the item and pay it off in a few installments.
And in terms of costs and benefits, clearly it doesn't attract any usurious interest charges. So for an economy like South Africa's, where we know many consumers at the base of the pyramid are stretched financially, this does seem to come with significant benefits.
Definitely. And if you go to any sort of shop and you go online, you could guarantee you're going to see a buy now, pay later option because it's been expanding so significantly. And it shows how attractive it is as a payment method because, you know, consumers, especially now that they're stretched, if you can get something now and pay it over a few months without being charged interest, it's obviously a very attractive proposition. It also allows you to manage your income and be able to do it at a time at which is not stretching your budget. So it comes at a time where such, you know, optionality is very important for the consumer who's currently stretched, but also at a time also where online retail shopping has gained, you know, traction. And this is the platform at which it's most readily available. If you know, like I say, you go to, you know, go shopping online, you know, go to the checkout, you'll see the pay buy now, pay later. And there's even more providers now that have gone into the space. So it's definitely become an attractive offering and it's gathering, you know, quite a lot of steam in terms of not just globally, but also in South Africa as well.
Why is it making headlines now, though?
So, you know, it's kind of in, you know, in a gray area. It's pretty much like shadow banking, where, you know, this doesn't have any regulation around it. And this has come to, you know, to regulators globally are now picking up that, you know, this is a problem. If you as a consumer are knowing that you can get this item and, you know, this it's not seen as a credit product, you can go and sign up to 5 different buy now, pay later, and you could potentially stretch yourself. So these are kind of risks now starting to emerge around buy now, pay later. And regulators, you know, we've seen the US and UK regulators both step in to say, look, they're trying to protect the consumers, and now they're trying to look in terms of what regulations need to be put in place, because not only is it growing in terms of traction, but also they're seeing a lot of, you know, risk and potential, you know, blind spots in terms of how it could expose consumers. And, you know, this is the way things work. When a new product is brought to the market, you know, everyone needs to find their feet in terms of, you know, how it fits well, you know, is it good, you know, and try and scrutinize it.
Yeah.
And regulators are now, you know, kind of seeing that buy now, pay later, although it's good, it has a lot of risk as well.
Well, isn't that, and we talk about open banking and open finance, David, and banking as a service, and they say, oh, the fintechs will come and, you know, the traditional banks will do the back office stuff, risk and compliance, what they're good at, and then we'll put it over through APIs, we'll get the fintechs to offer all of these cool new products. But yeah, you are introducing a whole range of new systemic risk potentially. When do you see the regulators getting involved in this area here in South Africa?
I'm sure they will become involved, because this is it's the same as cryptocurrency. No, it's not the same as crypto. It's the same problem of regulation. So once you're lending money and once you're taking deposits, then banks have to pay the price of all the capital regulations and the liquidity regulations, the market conduct regulations. So it's very attractive for a fintech to pop up who have no regulations to bear upon them, or a buy now, pay later scheme. And ultimately, in a slow way, it becomes more and more apparent that it must fall under a banking license, ultimately, so that provisions can be made, so that the customer can be protected. And this process of ignoring the banking regulations always results finally in the definitions widening and the coming together of the parties. So I personally think it's a great product. There's a great deal of optionality in it. I think the regulations will be fairly straightforward, is if you offer that product, you need to declare certain information, potentially make provisions. And before you know it, that's going to collapse under a banking license. Not collapse, I mean, it's going to be under a bank.
Fall under, yeah, absolutely. Now, one day we also saw US banks getting the green light to boost returns to shareholders following the period of very prudent provisioning thanks to COVID. Do you see that following through into our banks as well? Just take me through what we're seeing here.
So I don't think so. You know, I think, you know, the banks, you know, even some banks actually pulled back in terms of how much dividends they're going to pay out. But I expect our banks to remain within their guided given covered ranges, and they're not going to be extra generous, especially since our economy is, you know, still facing a lot of challenges. It's not as if that our macro outlook is very positive and gives them confidence to give shareholders more returns. So I think, you know, given especially how the current macro environment is looking quite dim, I think they'll take a forward view to say, look, it's going to be a tough environment. Earnings growth, you know, especially after this in the second half of the year, may be very challenging. So I think they would more likely, you know, maybe preserve some capital. They will, you know, obviously still give out dividends and they'll be in line. But we're not going to see, you know, too many instances of, for example, a special dividend.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be some wariness going forward now just because of the very uncertain environment. Although we're going to see some good growth out of there of the earnings just from, you know, recovering, for example, like, you know, there's sort of revenue numbers that are going to be, you know, improving in these results, but we're not expecting huge returns to shareholders.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be about those outlook statements as we await the local bank earnings as well. Just as we've got 2 minutes left, and I wanted to touch on this, David, there was so much more still to get through. We need an hour, guys. In the End of Money, you actually developed a thesis and spent a lot of time around the Chinese banking system, and it's very shadowy, it's very difficult to understand and unpack. Are you concerned here with what we're seeing on the run on these rural Chinese banks of systemic risk broadly into some of the bigger state-owned banks in China?
Absolutely. I'm 100% sure that these are the barbarians at the gates. These are the early warning signs. Not even early warning signs. These are now we're in the West able to see these events public, you know, on TV. So as I've long argued, the Chinese banking system is incredibly over-leveraged, 3.5 to 4 times over-leveraged, and that's not even counting the assets, the bad loans that were put into the AMCs. I think that this explains the entire Chinese story of why they clamped down on Hong Kong, and it's my thesis that the reason for the incredible aggression in which they clamped down on the Uyghurs and on any malcontent or any kind of Western liberal freedom of speech is because they already knew in 2018 that they were heavily overleveraged and that they had bought growth. So I've long predicted, and I hope I'm not right, but I've long predicted that this entire banking system needs to, in some way, unwind slowly or collapse.
And then the broad question would be, you know, what are the consequences for the world and for us here in South Africa? Perhaps we can unpack that on another panel. We've run out of time. That was David Buckham, MD of Monocle Solutions, who's joined by Mwandle Mthombeni, Senior Banks Analyst at IntelliDex, running the rule of some big issues, both in local and global banking circles here on Business Watch. We'll be right back.